Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to another exciting episode of the Vinnie Eastwood Show, broadcasting live from New Zealand, the wonderful island paradise that will be the site of everybody's enslavement under the Trans-Pacific Partnership Agreement. Yep, this is where it's going to be signed. This is ground zero, and I've just found myself in the middle of it all of a sudden. Isn't that great? However, we're not going to be talking about that today. We have a very special guest on the line, Jerry Ashton. Jerry, welcome to the program.
Well, thank you for inviting me.
Well, you know, I just got your email this morning, bro, and I was thinking, man, I need a guest that I need to use this platform for something good, right?
Absolutely, and I'm so honored.
Well, don't be. It's about to get a lot worse. Anyway, would you mind starting off by telling us a little bit about yourself and what it is you do?
Jerry Ashton, and for those who use Twitter, and I'm sure that your readers, your listeners do, it's @writtenoffusa. That's one of my handles. Another handle would be @RIP, medical debt. RIP Medical Debt, and I am the co-founder of an organization called RIP Medical Debt, which purpose here in the United States is to accept donations from people to go out and use their money and go out to the debt market and locate medical debt, which is unpaid, and to buy that debt to keep it out of the hands of bill collectors, and then to abolish that debt with no obligation to the person whose debt we're abolishing. And to further that, my partner and I, one of the board members, a fellow by the name of Robert E. Goff, co-wrote with me a book that we just published on February 1 called The Patient, the Doctor, and the Bill Collector, an Obamacare and Medical Debt Collection Survival Guide. So basically, that's my story, and I'm calling you from New York City.
Is it just me, or is it not just medical debt, but there's all sorts of debt that are going on? However, somebody can get into debt for a car, and they're healthy when they do it, all right? So they don't really have that kind of hanging over their head, the sort of life or death scenario that'll force you to sign on the dotted line like you're in the Bedazzled movie or something, you know? By chance, is there a bunch of dare I say it, predatory loaning that goes out to people who are in desperate medical situations who don't have a quote, fucking choice?
Well, of course, you're sneaking in the glory that other countries have that we don't have here, and that is the what would appear to be a predatory nature of debt that's created by medical bills. In most civilized countries, there's socialized medicine, and your taxes pay for it. There's no huge medical bills that are run up, and therefore nobody is going to default because of medical bills. In fact, in the United States, over 60% of all bankruptcies are medical bill related. That's a problem that you don't have in New Zealand.
Well, 50% of all bankruptcies. Okay, because our prime minister is like a former Federal Reserve banker, like on the border of the on the New York, right? For like 2 years, chartered derivatives. And he comes in and he goes, hey, you know how we've got the socialized healthcare and everything in New Zealand? Well, it's just not profitable enough. And then like a day later or something, our, I think it's called ACC, it announces a $10 billion profit for the year and ever. And he's like, oh, well, you know, it's still in trouble and we're gonna eventually privatize it and sell everything off. And sell all your cunts out.
Whatever you do, don't ever allow yourselves to go privatizing your medicine, because why in the world should someone's medical pain, which wasn't elected, by the way, it's not like going out and buying that car or the widescreen TV, why should their medical problem become a profit center for an insurance company, for a medical practice, for a hospital, for big pharma? How can that possibly happen? You guys are very fortunate. Don't let that happen down there.
What do you call a person that preys on the sick, the weak, and the vulnerable?
A bastard.
Okay, well, in fact, It's not a definitive article, is it? There's lots of things you could call him. We could make a list.
Well, I probably, maybe that part might be cut out when we have a transcript of this, but yeah, anybody who basically, in my world, and by the way, I'm a former bill collector, but I want you to understand that I know both sides of the fence. There's some bills that need to be paid. And then again, there are some bills that I find to be morally objectionable, and as a bill collector, I wouldn't touch them. For example, payday loans, that sort of thing. Medical bills, it's regrettable, but those are legal here in the United States. So what do I call people who take advantage of those unfortunates? I would call them predatory, of course.
So what's the nature of a predator? You know, what do they want from these people? Do they just want to take their money and then leave them to die? Or is that just what happens in the course of taking their money?
That's the unfortunate byproduct of a capitalist-oriented medical system. If you don't have enough money to pay for it, then, of course, you're going to suffer the consequences, and some of that times it can result in someone dying. If you take a look at the way that we do medicine here in the United States, I can walk into an emergency room, and I can have a problem, and they can fix that problem, and the government will take care of it because it's an emergency situation. Then there's Medicare, and then there's Medicaid. These are things that take care of people who have absolutely no money or people who would be of a certain age where they're entitled to have medical assistance at no charge, covered by taxpayers. So here in the United States, they have a fellow by the name of Bernie Sanders running who wants to take what we call Medicare and make it generally available to the public, Medicare for the masses. And, of course, that's being fought rigorously and vigorously by the insurance companies, by Big Pharma, by, frankly, by anybody who has a financial stake in the outcome.
You know, it seems like America is not a capitalist country because capitalism's when the capital's supposed to run everything. Fascism's when the people who have all the capital that they stole from everybody else run everything.
Well, if you take a look at the statistics about the 1% that own most of the wealth of the entire world, we're no different here in the United States. I'm sure there must be some reflection of that in New Zealand and down under as well.
Yeah, global corporate fascism. Essentially, it's a big problem, isn't it?
It's a big problem, yes.
Now, yes. Is it the source of all our problems? And in fact, somebody was having a conversation with me the other night about this, about, oh my God, the problems of the world are so big. What do I do? And I go, well, imagine just trying to figure out everything that's going on in your body right now. What are your G proteins up to? Okay. Is your spinal subluxated? You know, is there a whole bunch of different things that are going on in your body, just however many heartbeats per minute, how much oxygen you're inhaling, exhaling, that kind of thing. Sounds really complicated, right? But if you get a cut on your hand and you go, how do I fix that? You can come up with a solution pretty quick, right? So that's what people do. Yeah. They don't look at the entire system because it is too complex to understand, but they can understand one little part of it and how to fix it. You've picked yours, the medical debt, which is no doubt causing a lot of stress. And guess what causes 90% of all fucking illness?
What?
Stress!
Well, I would have voted for that, but I also would have voted for the toxins that have been created in our environment. There's so many things that affect our body. But going back to the idea that you had of being overwhelmed by the problem and having a problem with coming up with solutions, what happened is that in New York City, almost 5 years ago, an odd little event happened called Occupy Wall Street. And in Occupy Wall Street, they created in Zuccotti Park what they called working groups. And one of these working groups was called Rolling Jubilee. What they were doing was looking at the problem of debt in general, and medical debt in particular. And what they did was an unusual tactic, which was to go out and raise some money from people who just donated for a random act of kindness. They donated money to the Rolling Jubilee of Occupy Wall Street in order for the Rolling Jubilee to go out and buy unpaid medical debt from the debt industry and then abolish it. And that's very few people are even aware of that. I was a great fan of what they were doing. When I discovered that they were no longer doing it, that they had gone on to bigger and better things, which is taking on student debt here in the United States, as well as all debt, and they were no longer going to be focusing on medical debt, my partner Craig Antico and I, we're both from the collections industry, we decided to take up that mantle, inspired by what had been going on. And so we created in America what is called a 501c3 corporation in order to have the mechanics there so that we, again, could raise money and then go out and buy debt and abolish it. So we came from a solution-oriented basis. There's a problem. We can't change, at the moment, the essence of that problem, which is a very corrupt system. But at least we could take care of the byproduct of that thing that we call a medical system. Does that answer your this question, so to speak?
It's a cut on the hands, and you're applying a Band-Aid so that it heals. You know, it's pretty straightforward.
Yes, yes. Mm-hmm. Well, what happens is that if you cut your hand and you go to a doctor in the U.S. and you don't pay that bill, you're going to end up in a collection agency. You're then going to be called by the collection agent for God only knows how long. Then eventually that account might be purchased by debt buyers. And let's say that's $1,000 account, $1,000 bill. That's U.S. dollars, of course. $1,000 bill, and you can't afford to pay it. Somebody buys that from the hospital for as little as a penny on the dollar. So your $1,000 was just purchased for $10. But guess what they do with that? They sell it to a collection agency for maybe 3 cents on the dollar, so they paid $30. So they bought my pain from a debt seller for $30. But when they call me, they're calling for $1,000, and they want that money, and they want it now. So that's the plight that we in America face. And God forbid that this should ever happen in New Zealand or Australia.
Now, I just was questioning for a moment there. What is a debt industry? You know, like, I know what a steel industry is. They make something. It's called steel. And I know what the corn industry is because they make corn. I know what the forestry industry makes. They make wood. What the hell does the debt industry make?
They make money, and they make money off of people who default.
So they don't produce anything. They don't create anything. What? They don't contribute anything. They don't produce anything of value. They're playing musical chairs on a grand profit scale.
Well, you know, it's even worse than that, because what they do is they take debt, and this is where people defaulted for whatever reason, and they trade that amongst themselves. And each of them working hard to be able to collect, squeeze a dollar out of these people that have defaulted on some agreement. And that's how they make their money. They're not constructing anything. They're not building highways. What they're doing is they're contributing to political parties. What they're doing is they're funding a lot of people on K Street that do the lobbying here in the United States. It's just a mess.
It's literally,
and it's all based on greed.
It's literally a money go-round, isn't it?
Oh, that's a nice way of putting it, yes. It's a money go-round, and everybody's climbing on that horse.
And some people keep going up on those horses, and everybody else just keeps going down, you know? Now, this is corporate welfare at its worst, don't you think?
Well, it's not corporate welfare. It's called business as usual. Corporate welfare consists of the money that we in America give to the banks so that they can fund these people who are debt buyers. Debt buyers don't have the money to go out and buy debt. They have to go to Wall Street. So they'll go out to Wall Street, and they'll borrow $100 million, and then, of course, they can go out and buy $10 billion worth of debt.
Whoa. They get into debt with bankers so that they can buy debt off wankers, and then they go to people to extract it.
You're seeing a merry-go-round, I see.
Ah, You see, I always find we're always at the bottom of the fucking pyramid on this one, aren't we, bro? You know? Because,
yep.
Look, if you're not a brutal sociopathic scumbag, okay, you work for a living. And you think to yourself, hey, I've got to do something productive, I've got to contribute to my society, I've got to actually do something of value. I want to be able to fucking sleep at night. Now, but some people, they don't have a conscience to keep them up at night. So those thoughts don't occur to them. They're like, how much money and power and scumbaggery can I get accumulated while I'm still alive and try to stay alive for as long as humanly possible and sabotage everybody who competes with me or tries to stop me? I'll get into the debt industry. Sussed.
Yep. Well, what you're looking at is a magnificent sense of scarcity, because people who are scumbags in the sense that you described them, people who are desperate to make more money at the cost and the benefit of themselves and the cost to others, they're so afraid that they're not going to have enough money that they take money from everybody that they possibly can. So it's really, it's not coming from abundance, it's coming from scarcity. It's a psychological deficit that's happening in people. Gecko, in that famous movie Wall Street, said greed is good. I can tell you, greed is evil. So I'm going to pitch my book again. Of course, you guys won't be buying it down in New Zealand, but it's called The Patient, the Doctor, and the Bill Collector, and Obamacare and Medical Debt Collection Survival Guide. But I also want to remind you of RIP medical debt, because any individual, and we didn't start out this way, by the way, we just wanted to do what we had to do, but any individual can fight the system if they're willing to be creative. So we saw something very creative. We said, well, my God, if we can take our debt industry background, our knowledge, and put that to work for good rather than bad, why not do that? And that's exactly what we do. And we have a website for the book called No More Medical Debt. NoMoreMedicalDebt.com.
Now, essentially what you're saying is America took the wrong choice when they did privatized healthcare, because essentially it only opens it up for predatory borrowing from society's most vulnerable, and that's essentially, at its core, an immoral thing to do to an entire nation full of people.
Well, I hesitate to go totally immoral on this, although it's very, very tempting. What has happened is that there's been a system that's set up that feeds greed.
When did it start?
It's greed that's immoral.
Where did this medical debt mafia kind of come from? Do they have like an origins? Were they gestating inside a government department for several years or something like that, unbeknownst to it, and then erupted forth, birthed in a fiery, milky pit of afterbirth and into this realm, yeah. And then grown up, sprouted like, legs and arms and suits and ties, and went out and started fucking people over?
No, like every cancer, it starts with a bad cell, and then it multiplies, and then it grows, and then it destroys its own host. So this is why we continually come into these economic crises that we continue to do here in the world, and certainly in the United States. Every time we have these crises, are you there?
Oh, yeah.
I'm sorry, Arthur, I lost you. Every time we have a crisis or a depression or a recession, it's caused by the fact that the greed finally caught up with the people that are causing it. But in America, what we do, instead of bailing out the people, we bail out the bastards that put us into the problem to begin with. It's just revolting.
Okay. So how can we even get this down? I mean, do we have like lists of companies that we can run through that are actually responsible for this, or are they simply shell companies that sort of like lead up to a central core or somebody in the banking sector or something like that that's sort of supplying all this?
Well, the debt buying industry isn't very well known. There's sort of a shadow industry back there. Again, they are funded by the banks, which help them buy the debt. And the debt is created by way of of the hospitals, which charge for the services they do. And the hospitals are forced into this system because the only way they're going to be able to pay their own bills is by charging somebody money to take care of that cut finger that you're talking about, or the sextuple bypass that I once had. So that's what they're looking to do. It's part of a system. It's a corrupt system. So to blame people other than Wall Street, which is more than happy to foster and keep this going, to blame people that are part of an industry that's doing what they can to make money off of what exists, you have to go after the system.
Yeah.
That doesn't mean you can't. You got to parade in front of the banks, but you got to go after the system.
Yeah, it's like the Chinese saying, a fish rots from the head. If it's if there's some corruption, if there's some something stinky going on, have a look at the very top, and you'll usually find your answer.
And the American equivalent is follow the money.
Because in America, money always goes to the top. It's like reverse gravity.
Well, it's like a vacuum cleaner. It's designed to suck every available dollar out of our pockets and bring it up to the 1%. That's how the system works.
Have you looked into the history of the debt companies and the bankers or any of the stuff to see what the origins of how they're actually now able to do what they're kind of doing, what legislative frameworks were put in place to allow it to be done legally?
Yeah, there's the Federal Reserve, there's the banking system that's been set up, there are the different acts that have been created and opposed.
I'm talking specifically about medical debt.
Oh, medical debt. Well, in medical debt alone, it was creeping. It sort of crept up on us. Somehow or another, we ended up in a system that required people to be insured by non-governmental agencies, by business. So business steps up and says, I'll insure you. And of course, business, because it's in the business to make a profit, says, I'll insure you, providing you do not have pre-existing conditions, providing you pay me so much money, providing you don't lean on this too much, providing I can cap the amount of money that you get. So this is where the evil came in. And when the Obamacare system, the ACA, the Affordable Care Act, was brought into existence, what they did is they brought the insurance companies into the back room to help them hammer this out. Now, obviously,
the way I hear it, they openly hammered it out by themselves and then just gave it to the government to okay and sign off.
It's pretty close to that. When you take a look at some of these things that happen, and I'm sure it happens there as well, because there are evil people. There are backward-thinking people in every country, in every society. So these people that wanted to fill their pockets and made sure that the people whose pockets were filled would take care of them as well. This is the ever and ongoing challenge that you and I as human beings face.
Well, I think it was Lorraine Warren. She's one of the most famous paranormal researchers and ghost hunters, demon trappers, whatever you want to call her. But I saw a quote from her the other day, and she said that evil can be contained so long as we remain vigilant, but it can never fully be destroyed.
It really is like a black spot. It's like in a swimming pool of beautiful clear water, you empty one ink vial into it. It's not as quite as pure as it once was. It's still beautiful, but there's still a tinge in there. So it does require vigilance. So what that means is it requires that people wake up. And it's hard to wake up because nobody wants to wake up to a nightmare.
You know, that's actually quite a profound statement. A lot of people want to wake up from nightmares, but the biggest nightmare is that they're actually waking up into one, that they just can't see it because
exactly.
They don't know that it's going on.
That's right. It's another form of the Matrix. When you take a look at the fact that you and I are living our lives and we're paying our bills and buying our groceries and watching TV, and we go through our life in lockstep, bringing in money barely enough, putting the money out. What the hell are we doing here when you realize that there's something more important involved, and that important thing is to see that every one of us have a chance to win, not just the 1%, the 99%, irregardless of color, creed, or religion.
And all that's required is for the 1% to not be psychopathic criminals who want to hoard everything for themselves. Essentially, that's the problem I see, is an insatiable thirst for wealth. Wealth
Sweet.
That is not required for a happy life. In fact, I saw this article one time in the Daily Telegraph, which I found particularly telling. Interesting thing for a telegraph. But it said that money does buy happiness. However, it's 60 grand a year. Beyond that, ain't no guarantees. You know what 60 grand a year gets you? It gets you a comfortable place to live, good food, clean water, strong internet, and no worries about whenever your next bill's coming in. What it does is just take away your worries. The real problem then
sets in
when you start to realize that there isn't actually any major challenges in your life. And like a tree that hasn't been exposed to wind for a long time, it becomes fragile, weak, easily blown over. And I think this is one of the true challenges of mankind, is to figure out a way to perpetually challenge ourselves and make ourselves better people and not stagnate into one path or another, but be able to walk many.
That part is true. First of all, heal thyself. Every one of us needs to take a look at our own appetites. What am I? How much do I need? What am I spending it on? And why? What am I getting in return for this? Once a person has a chance to take a look at their own way of dealing with money, and they can come to terms with that, then and only then, it's a wake-up process. You look around and realize that the system perpetuates an insanity. And that insanity is what has to be attacked. And that's where your listeners need to say, I am going to put my feet on the street. I am going to write that letter. I am going to go out and vote. I am not going to allow people to direct my life in a fashion which is deleterious to me and to my society.
Yeah, it's that old adage, if you don't do anything, that's the only time where you can guarantee that you'll have no effect. Whether to stop something bad or bring something good about, if you don't do anything, you're not going to affect the outcome. Well, and people have been just so disempowered.
I hate that word disempowered. That's bullshit. We're all empowered. We just simply don't turn on our own switches.
And disempowerment is bullshit, because have you ever noticed that, like, people are like, oh no, I don't want to do that. I mean, what if people judge me or anything? Yeah, but what if you do nothing because you're too worried about people judging you, that you do nothing with your fucking life because you're too afraid of being judge cunt? All right. There's a whole world out there.
Well, it doesn't look very good on your tombstone, saying, I could have.
I think I can. No. It'll be like a little train, and it says, I think I can, but I didn't.
It's worse than that. Most people don't even think they can. And the reality is, people have so much power, so much capability. Occupy Wall Street was a wake-up call for me. Prior to Occupy Wall Street and the crash that we had, I was writing a book, and I'm still writing the damn thing, called Written Off America. And it was all about debt, and all about what caused the crash on Wall Street. And then when Occupy came into existence, that caused me to question everything. Why am I talking about debt? Why should debt even exist to begin with? Now, that's a profound question. Why does medical debt in the United States of America, why does it exist to begin with? Why can we take $10 billion to put one spy plane into the air and not be able to support clean water in Flint, Michigan, and poison our own people. So this is the insanity that each individual must honestly take a look at and say, I will not put up with this anymore.
Well, somebody asked me this once, and I said, well, look, just imagine that I told you that the world is run by insane people. Does it suddenly make a whole lot of sense why the world is the way it is?
Well, you don't have to imagine it. It is.
Hey, you know, if you can dream it. And you have to laugh at the insanity. Like, I figured this out a while ago. You can either try to comprehend the insanity, and then what happens is you just start going nuts. Or you can start laughing at how arbitrarily insane it is just from the outset, you know? Like, I don't know.
And then you have one of two choices. You either withdraw into yourself and kiss off all possibilities of making a difference, or you go out there and you do the horrible, awful, day-to-day slogging that it takes to be able to make what we call a difference. So I can tell you that it has not been easy creating a nonprofit that's sole purpose is to take bad debt off the backs of people and raise money for that. It was no easy slog to be able to spend something like 18 months writing this book, because I knew that at least the book would be an educational device that would bring people's attention to the need. So I'm not saying this by way of complaint. I'm saying this by way of acknowledging the fact that there ain't nothing easy. And if you're not willing to pay the price, you're not willing to have the gold.
You get what you pay for.
You get what you pay for.
And I find this also one of those unique challenges in life, to find something that frustrates and angers you so much that you can forge a happy existence fucking with it.
I think you've identified me. And I think I'm kind of fucking with the system here. And this, of course, will be taken out in the Puritan American version, I hope.
But if you say so.
I started, I went down to Occupy Wall Street and was in there chronicling what they were doing. I just had to make a record of it. And one day, some people from the Huffington Post came down and came up to me and said, we'd like to interview some people here in Occupy Wall Street. I was working for as part of their press thing. And I was running around all over the park trying to find somebody that would talk to them, and everybody was too busy. So they were frustrated, so that they said, why don't we interview you? So I said, well, okay. So they interviewed me, and I was the very first voice of Occupy Park, as done by the Huffington Post. So here I am talking about Occupy and why I, at my age, decided to go down and see what was going on and what I could contribute and learn from it. Then I ended up writing for the Huffington Post. So hopefully some of your listeners, if they're Huffington Post fans, can look up Jerry Ashton there and follow me too. So you never can tell. The best way to get run over is to stand in the middle of the freeway.
I think we have too much obsession with comfort and convenience, you know? Like, we have elections, and the major election season, like when everybody's supposed to vote, tend to be coinciding with major sports events, don't they? And then you go, hey. Hey, and then we got very low voter turnout. I wonder how people are prioritizing their lives, you know? Hey, look, over here, there's some men, some short shorts, some balls rubbing against each other really vigorously. Mate, that's freaking entertainment. I'm going to buy a T-shirt about it. I'm going to buy a hat and a jacket, and I'm going to go to the games. Hey, look over here, there's some scumbags who are actually taking over your entire country by stealth because you don't bother to vote. Ah, who cares, mate? I'll have another beer. Should we write? Oh, God.
Yes, you are. And take a look at the government that manipulates the dates on which people vote, the dates on which people meet, to make sure. And in a way, you kind of have to be happy, because all the idiots are at the sports games, and hopefully the brain, you know, the brainy people, the ones that think about things, might be showing up at some voting event. Who knows?
Which explains why there's 100,000 screaming fans at the sporting event, and like 12 people in the audience at the voting one.
No, if the people at the sporting events put that same energy into changing government, it would be awesome. And
hey, maybe this might be an idea.
Very slowly, this is happening. What's that?
Maybe this might be an idea, bro. Like, hijack the PA system at a giant sports field or something like that, and just rack up the crowd into some kind of political frenzy or whatever. But and then just, you know, command them to file out of the giant sports arena, to march towards the mayor's office or something like that, and sit outside and throw half empty cans and bottles at the at his front door, demand that he release some political prisoner. I don't think it'd work, because they're not in that mindset. Like, you actually have to be tuned on, hooked in. You have to be raised with something. You have to have an experience. And I think society's structured in such a way that it prevents people from being raised properly, prevents them from having new experiences, and prevents them, most of all, from thinking, because they're too well entertained. And in so doing, what it's done is it's crafted society down. It's almost like whittled us down like a pencil, into this very sharp point where there's only actually a few people that are now making all the difference in society, and everybody else has been reduced to a bystander, politically or sport-wise. That's what's happened, isn't it? People used to be independent. People are always used to contribute in their own unique and different and wonderful ways, but that thing's been robbed from all of us without our knowledge over a long period of time.
Well, it takes heroes. It takes people who are above and beyond to be able to go out there and question the authority, to make that difference, to catch enough attention so that a small percentage of the population can change things. So don't think for one minute that one person can't change things. And I feel sorry for, and I mean that sadly, because I don't want to see these people as victims. I feel sorry for those who are unwilling to think. I feel sorry for them because they've lost so much of who they are, and they've lost so much of what they can contribute to our society.
I could just imagine this. What if I never did any thinking my entire life? And school doesn't count. Neither does university. They don't teach you how to think. They teach you how to regurgitate, right? And that's what my whole life would have been if one of my flatmates, who still owes me money, bastard, didn't show me a documentary called Truth and Lies of 9/11 by Michael C. Rupert, and introduced me to a number of other different ideas, and now here I am, right? And people don't understand... Mm-hmm. How influential they actually are to those people around them, just so long as you're giving them positive influences that open them, not things that are just the same old, same old. I mean, that's why I don't run my show like everybody else runs their show. Everybody else wants to shock, jock, and give you the breaking news that I don't know anything about because it's breaking. You know, what the fuck is the point in that? Why can't you just have it nice? Nice?
Well,
fun? Enlightening?
You hit the nail on the head. You hit the nail on the head. One individual who imparted knowledge and wisdom to another individual can make all the difference. Now, in your listening audience, there are bound to be people who are just ready to hear this. There are some people that have already heard it and they simply need to have it confirmed. And there are some people who said, "What? I never heard of that." So, your willingness to go on the air, do you go on every night?
I did, but now I've got like so many different projects on, I'm only really managing two shows a week.
Okay. So every time you go on, it's one more opportunity for you to reach out and touch at least one person.
Well, and I also...
And that's your job.
Unlike a lot of other talk radio show hosts, I communicate with my audience. Answer pretty much every email, pretty much every single Facebook message, pretty much every single YouTube comment and stuff like that. I'm very, very accessible. And the part of the reason why I do that is because I think that when a lot of the very influential and people who I was like, oh my God, really like total fanboy at the time, actually replied to my Facebook messages, it made me feel like a better person. Just because somebody who I thought was greater than me was communicating with me. And then I later find out that you're not supposed to think that other people are greater than you or better than you in any way, shape, or form, because you're just putting them into a pedestal and they'll become a fucking dictator someday, right? And the other thing
wait,
is...
Wait, I had to stop you on that. One of the things that Occupy encountered in Zuccotti Park was this belief that they were leaderless. And they didn't, everyone was a leader, in other words. And they were very suspicious of the people that you're talking about that might end up on a pedestal. To that extent, they damaged themselves, because there are some people that are worth looking up to. I look up to Mahatma Gandhi. I look up to Rosa Parks. I look up to Franklin Delano Roosevelt. I look up to Nelson Mandela. I look up to them, not because they're superior to me, but they show me what I can become.
Now,
so you have
that,
no reason.
That
no
is,
reason.
In fact,
no
the
reason.
Entire point.
Yeah.
What you just described
yes.
is not putting someone on
okay.
a pedestal. It is looking at somebody, their achievements and their things, and then using them to inspire you. That way, you draw power from them rather
yes.
than them
yes.
drawing power from you. That's what I meant.
We are in agreement.
Now, this has happened a lot lately, how we start arguments sometimes in our lives, even with close friends, but we're not actually arguing with each other. We're actually in full agreement.
No, I don't think that you and I, for example, were arguing. You put out a point of view which maybe I didn't understand, so I needed to put mine out. Then we found out where we had middle ground, where we could agree on something.
Well,
I don't mind disagreeing with people.
Yeah. It's the points on upon which we agree we can come together and collaborate, and sometimes those points we disagree upon can be left for another time, preferably a time when we're not under the threat of ruthless enslavement by criminal sociopathic banking scumbags.
Well, this is the idea. We have been so separated amongst ourselves, conservatives, liberals, blacks, whites, this and that, and this absolutely serves the people at the top, because the more we argue about our differences down below, the less attention we pay to the people above. So I'm always interested in what people say that I differ with. Not because I want to start arguing with them, but just saying, well, putting that aside, where can we find a point of agreement? And once we find a point of agreement, then we find power. Then we're two of us. There's no longer one of us. It's two of us, and then it's going to be three of us, and then it's going to be five of us, and then it's going to be thousands of us.
Now, a lot of people who joined Occupy, like I was a bit of a part of Occupy here in New Zealand in Auckland when it was going on. I did all the, I did a hell of a lot more videos than their entire media team did, just by myself.
Right.
And some of them were rude to me. Some of them accused friends of mine who have been activists for like 40 years in this country of being SIS operatives. And I'm just like, oh, bro. And this is the thing, exactly as you were talking about, that suspicion of other people around you. People don't realize that leadership isn't tyranny, okay? Sometimes a leader is actually a good leader because he says what you think and represents your views, doesn't lie to you, doesn't misrepresent what they're doing, behaves honorably. Okay? People think
absolutely.
That because somebody's wanting to be a leader, that they're all of a sudden some kind of an infiltrator or a scumbag, or they want power and influence for themselves, or they're a sociopath, and they instantly like track down that negative path, when they don't realize that throughout the course of history, leaders have been tyrants and bastards, but they've also been very benevolent and have saved countless lives. Namely, because people put aside their belief in that everybody who wants to lead anybody is a dictator and just have a look at somebody for the quality of their character.
Well, let's take a look at that. We have learned as a society, as humanity, that some leaders are, in the end, have led people in the wrong direction. You take a look at what's happening in the political system here in America. I won't even go into the details, and I'm not going to reveal who I like or I don't like. But if you take a look at the rabble-rousing and the pandering that's going on by people who are attempting to be elected president of the United States, and they're appealing to the worst natures of the people below them because that's where the votes are. When I see that, I don't blame whatsoever anybody in Occupy for saying, I cannot trust a leader. But what they do is they throw out the baby with the bathwater. They forget about the leaders that made the difference. They forget about the Martin Luther King. They forget about the John F. Kennedy. They forget about the Franklin Delano Roosevelt. They forget about the people who were leaders not because they said, I am going to be the leader. They said, it's been thrust upon me, and I'm willing to accept that role.
I think if there is anything to learn about the human condition, our desire to lead and be led, is that sometimes you actually do need to stand together, and often you'll need to stand behind someone, all of you, together,
yep.
Right?
Yep.
And fulfill your roles. I mean, it's just like people sometimes get jealous, and it's just like, dude, okay, we're a human body. We're a human being with a human body. The kidney doesn't go, oh, I wish I was the heart. It's way more important than me. You just be like, kidney, bro, if you weren't there doing what you're doing, all of us would be fucked, mate, okay? Just keep doing what you're doing.
Yep.
It's very important. Even if you don't think that you're appreciated, everything falls apart without you. That's how important you actually are, okay? You have your own intrinsic value.
Yep, and that's why any part of the body that says, I'm picking up my marbles, I'm going home, I'm not playing this game, absolutely destroys the rest of the body.
See, everything's absolutely necessary. And so if it's the one great cosmic irony of modern life, people who sit there and think, oh, I can't do anything important.
Oh, my God, just realize you have unlimited potential and you're wasting it. Every moment of every day, you're wasting it.
This is part of the waking up process. Are you familiar with the crab barrel effect?
Oh, yeah. Well, in New Zealand, we call it the tall poppy syndrome. Anybody starts being any more successful or starts doing anything different, you essentially get ostracized, which is, incidentally, also a mind control technique. Ostracize people who think differently, have a central authority, make sure everybody's a bit sleep deprived, and, Bob's your uncle. You've got a whole bunch of mind control people called school students.
Yep. And there you are. And this is where the wake-up is required. People either continue to keep other people from growing and other people from shining so that they don't look bad, or they're going to say, well, I'm going to risk trying to climb out of this crab barrel. I don't care how many crabs are trying to pull me back.
Will one ever even make it out of the barrel as well? And here's the problem that I find with analogies, and I should know, because I'm pretty anal about my analogies and my analysis. Because what seems to happen is crab comes out of the barrel and he gets pulled down. But what about the crab that actually makes it? All right? He's usually the one that gets stepped on by the big boots of the fisherman who caught all the crabs in the first fucking place, isn't it? See?
You're no fun to talk to. Would you leave this poor crab alone? It got out of the barrel and went back to the ocean and lived happily ever after, and led a whole bunch of crabs to rise up against All the lobstermen, okay?
Yeah. All the tyrannical lobsters got fucked up with the gargantuan crab army. And just like, can you just imagine the lobster, you know, with his little lobster spear or something like that, and he's wearing a lobster seaweed grass skirt kind of thing. He's like sitting there doing some sort of ceremony. He looks over. He's like, oh my God. Guys, we've got crabs! There's too many of them! Now, could we all do so? And be really nippy about it, you know.
So now that we've had such levity, what is it that you'd like to get out of this conversation with me, Jerry Ashton?
I wanted to know why you spent 40 years doing debt collection agency and what made you stop it.
That's a profound question. Why would somebody stop doing what they're doing?
We have a second hour.
Yeah. Oh my God. I'm not sure I can handle that. It's a little bit late here in New York City. What I always did, and this is where you need to honor professions and make sure you don't confuse the individuals with the profession. The profession of the bill collector is someone who steps in at some point in time when someone is not being paid for services or goods that they rendered in good faith. And somebody, for whatever reason, is not paying them. Now, that could be true of an advertiser for a channel like yours. It could be true for anything. Somebody bought something they didn't pay for. Now, very few people are equipped to be able to ask for their money. And so that's why they bring in a third party called the bill collector. So let's just say that they serve a function, much like someone who needs to pick up the garbage every day and get a handle. I looked at myself as not a garbage man. I looked at myself as a recycler. My job was to take the people that seemed to be in debt with my client, and I would look at the instances and circumstances, and I go back to my client and say, you know what? You should be on your hands and knees begging forgiveness. This is what you did wrong. This is what you didn't do. This is what you could have done. This is where you failed. This is where your product didn't deliver the goods. And that made me very unusual in my industry. Then the idea that I carried within me is that I would only go after a just debt. And a just debt was what I just described. It's something where someone in good faith gave a service or product, and for whatever reason, somebody's not paying them. They don't have the equipment or the personnel internally to chase after that money. Well, then they give it over to somebody like me. That was my job. So I was always contrarian. And there's an industry online publication called Inside Arm, which is Accounts Receivable Management, Inside Arm. And I would always be the gadfly. Every time I would go into that website, and I would post a blog, sure enough, I'd be blasted by half the people in my industry because I was contrary. I didn't go along with the thing. So just like you are, you're an unusual man within your industry. Well, that's what I was in the collections industry. Does that make sense to you?
It does. Very similar to how I went through sales. So we have a 5-minute break coming up. If you'd like to hang up, go grab a coffee and then ring on back in. I'd actually love to get into more detail.
Sure.
All right. We'll be right back, ladies and gentlemen, after the break at the VinnyEastwoodShow.com. That's Vinny with a Y, because it's the most important question. And Eastwood, like, go ahead. Make my news. Back in a moment. Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to hour number two of the fastest 2 hours in talk radio. It's the Vinny Eastwood Show, broadcasting from New Zealand, the shining jewel in the banker's feather in their cap in the South Pacific, which is more or less just a representation of the Cayman Island global conglomerate. Now, my very special guest joining me still is Jerry Ashton. Now, we were getting into this part about you. In 40 years' experience in the industry, did you get very well promoted? Were you really good at your job, or were you just trying to kind of stay humble and do the right thing, and didn't get promoted as a result?
Well, I started out selling collection services door to door for something called Transworld Systems, which was a prepaid system for people to take off. Put names on a little ledger, so to speak, and send it to our company so that we would generate a series of collection letters. And it was a very simple thing. People in small businesses needed to have a collection system come in, and I did that, and I did very well at that. And in the process of selling my system to people, I discovered that they weren't doing things right to begin with. They weren't making the contracts clear. They weren't making promises that could be delivered. They didn't have follow-up methods to be sure that people paid attention. So I began correcting them at the source rather than using the third party. I said, well, you really need to improve things internally. And all of mine was oriented towards customer service as opposed to towards being a third-party interventionist or, at the worst end of it, of the leg breaker. So over a period of time, I developed my own company, which developed what we called insourcing, where we put our collectors into the operation to work next to their collectors so that we could do a better job of managing accounts and keeping them from going out to collection agencies. So I was rather odd to begin with, so that's my story.
I wonder as well, did you ever ruffle a few feathers in the process of doing this? You know, somebody up there who just kind of a bit pissed off that somebody knows better than they do. Jerry, are you still there? Appear to have lost him. It's extremely unfortunate. So we've got nearly an hour to go left on it. You might have accidentally hit the mute button, Jerry, so if you can still hear me, just pretty simple. Hang up the phone and ring back, 218-339-8525. 218-339-8525. In the meantime, you're unmuted, so if you come back, that'll be nice. okay, Jerry's hung up. That's nice. I was thinking as well, just in terms of, like, debt and the creation of it completely out of nothing. It's a form of magic, I think, because you could buy real stuff with it, right? But the person who created it never had it to begin with, and they just give it to you. All right, so we've got Jerry back, I think. Jerry, welcome back.
I'm sorry. I lost you. I know what's happening. The entire collection industry and Wall Street and everybody is stopping this conversation.
If you say so. what was it? Sometimes people blame technical difficulties on intelligence agencies and big shadowy organizations instead of our own incompetence.
better to blame them.
You know, but it's a real trouble if you're like doing a private recording that nobody's listening to, because then you've got nobody to blame but yourself, you know.
Well, tell me where I lost you or I lost myself. What was I talking about?
Oh, now that's a very deep question there.
So basically, I was putting you to sleep too. Is that what you're telling me?
No. Well, where we were was
I was
asking
you about my history.
I was asking you about how did you rub any people the wrong way, or rather ruffle their feathers somewhat and get pissed off with you because you were better at their job than they were?
Well, actually, I was looked at as being odd. You know, it's not like I would upend a billion-dollar industry just because I do things differently. I was just looked at as being a little bit odd. That's all.
Like a novelty.
Like a novelty. Isn't that interesting?
Novelty debt collection.
I remember speaking at one conference, and at the back of the room, someone was talking to another bill collector organization, talking to this people, and he says, you know, that guy's kind of zany. And oddly enough, that person who called me zany, Craig Antico, ended up working for me and working with me because he loved the fact that we were so different. We were just anti-collection, anti-attorney, pro-relationship. So that's what these discerned us from other entities.
That kind of independent sort of spirit, you know, because I could tell, you know,
yep.
you when was the last time you said to yourself, You know, I'm never working for anyone again. I'm only going to work with people from now on.
Oh, I think that started maybe 60 years ago.
Early on, eh?
Yeah.
Well, it's just the thing. It's impossible for me, as an intelligent man, to do the exact same thing over and over and over again. You know? I mean, even if there's little differences and things like that, it's like, no. I need wondrous variety. I need different environments. I need different topics. I need all this sort of stuff, right? Now, when you were growing up, were you also considered a bit weird in school and stuff? And because where did your kind of beliefs in doing what's right came from?
Well, I grew up in, I was born in Oakland, California, the San Francisco Bay Area. And my family moved to Medford, Oregon, that's southern Oregon, in a small town. And I went through high school there. And I would be considered, except for a few classes I took where I was excelled, just another average guy. And at the and this was a long time ago. And when graduation came and everybody said, well, I'm going to UCLA, I'm going to U of O, I'm going to USN, I'm going to this and that. My story was I was going into the USN, United States Navy. Because I couldn't afford to go to college, and frankly, I wasn't really equipped to do that anyway. So I joined the U.S. Navy, and I'll give away my age here. That was in 1955. And I joined the Navy to go to Navy Journalist School, only to find out that the recruiter who got me to join up for 4 years hadn't told me all the story about being a journalist, and that was, you had to be 20 years old. You had to have 2.5 years of college. You had to have this and that. So I ended up in boot camp in San Diego, California. And I realized that for the next 4 years, I was going to be swabbing decks. And that was a horrible thought. So when the day came that, I was after a thought. So at the end of 3 months of being in boot camp, I went to the counselors who assigned us to schools. And he said, what would you like to do? And I said, it's hopeless. I can't do it. And he says, well, what's hopeless? And I said, I want to become a Navy journalist. And he says, well, what's the problem? And I said, well, I don't qualify. And I was conned into it by a recruiter. And so the guy looks at some of my test scores, and I'd been a journalist in high school, and I'd been a cub reporter for the Medford Mail Tribune, a local newspaper. And he says, well, let me see what I can do. And sure enough, when I left boot camp, it was with orders to go to the Navy Journalist School in Great Lakes, Illinois, where I became one of maybe several hundred Navy journalists at the age of 18. And that was in 1955. So that gives you an idea of just being in the right place at the right time. So going back to the idea of, have I always been the way that I am? I am now, that is. No, that's a process. I was just a guy doing my job. I loved what I did. I got out of the Navy. I went to college. I went to the University of Hawaii. I went to San Jose State College in San Jose, California. I married, raised, had kids. I was doing my work. I used to be a door-to-door book salesman for the Encyclopedia Britannica and did very well at that. So I'm just another bloke. I'm just another guy who was doing what he was doing. And then one day, I was invited to attend a personal growth workshop, personal growth seminar. Now, that in itself is a long conversation. So we went to something called LifeSpring, and in LifeSpring, on a 3-day weekend, all of a sudden, I was posed with the idea that there might be a different way of looking at things. And that was the beginning, where somebody said, there's a different way of looking at things. And it literally changed my life, and that was going back to 1978. So where I am now is a progression of having come across wonderful teachers, wonderful experiences of learning. Everything has been a lesson for me, and I've accepted them as graciously as possible. Some are less pleasant than others. Does that kind of reflect your life, too, in some fashion?
Yeah, mine was mostly just a wake-up period from trauma, You know how a lot of students, you know, they sell weed when they're in university to other students, right? Well, one of them narked on me, and so I was going to go to jail for up to 8 years for a first offence for 13 grams of cannabis. Fortunately, that didn't happen, because my mother got herself into massive amounts of debt, so he could pay for a lawyer who did one day in court. But I can't travel, like, ever to any country for the rest of my life because of something that happened to me when I was 19. And then I had a series of sales jobs, and I did really well at them until the boss realized that I was better at his job and I was a bit of a threat, and so they fired me. And it had three sales jobs in a row after that, and then I was just like, I almost had a nervous breakdown, and called a friend of mine who does this magazine here in New Zealand called Uncensored, because I'd only just started to, you know, become a bit of a, you know, open thinker after what had happened to me, and I just couldn't work for anybody anymore. Like, I almost had a panic attack thinking about going to work. So I stopped, and I took my paycheck, you know, it was like 20 grand, I think, for the month, and bought myself a fridge and a computer and a camera, and I've been filming protests and public meetings and exposing corrupt pieces of shit ever since. And I've been doing that for about 8 years now. And I've become the number one most subscribed YouTube news channel in New Zealand, with more subscribers than the New Zealand Herald, which the organization itself's been around for about 180 years.
So, yes, great.
So in 8 years, I could best them on YouTube. In fact, I bested them in like 2012. And it just, I do it because I'm angry, right? I'm really upset at what had happened to me. However, it's not just anger as well. It's also empathy, because I also realized that I wasn't the only one. And I realized I was one of the few with enough of a, you know, selfish, attention-seeking, limelight-loving kind of attitude to be up there, talk to all these people who don't have that kind of, you know, persona to run a radio show and do all this kind of stuff, but at least get the benefit of having the platform to tell their stories. Because if I tell my story, there's going to be somebody else out there who's listening. There might be one listening to any particular broadcast for whom that really resonates, and they change their life tomorrow for the better. And I think that that's the same thing with all of my guests. That's why I asked them how they started doing what they're doing, because I don't know, and I think it's really important, because the listener doesn't know either. And if it turns out to be something they can relate to really intensely, just that one person with those unique set of experiences, it'll inspire them to change. And that's what I hope to do.
Well, your story and my story resonates with people who have their own story. And what's interesting is that so many people out there don't realize that every piece of adversity that they've been getting really serves as grist for the mill. And everything that stops them from getting someplace is a test. It's like a saying that I enjoy, and that is, life is like a grinding wheel. Depending on what you're made of, it will either wear you down or it will polish you up. And we're looking for people, you and I, are looking for people who want to be polished up. We know that life is a grinding wheel. We just don't think we have to be victims of it. So I honor your story. And frankly, you are able to travel. The difference is you may not travel physically to any other country, but what you're doing and what you're saying is traveling, certainly here to New York City, and I'm sure quite a few other places.
I mean, for somebody who's not allowed to ever travel to the United States, I have more reach inside the United States than most New Zealanders that have ever lived.
You know, you and I first connected 2 years ago, I believe it was, in which I think you took notice of some work I was doing in Occupy, and you wanted to talk to me about, I can't remember the subject at the time. Oh, yes, citizen radio, citizen journalism, social media journalism. And I don't think we ever had that conversation. Would you like to have it now?
You know, I think we should.
I think we should, because we're engaged in it right now. When I, going back to the idea, I started out as a Navy journalist as an 18-year-old, and 4 years later was discharged honorably as a Navy journalist second class. I really didn't follow journalism because I got interested in sales. I always wanted to write, but there's more money in selling things down the street, door-to-door, commission only. So I went into sales, and I raised my family and went through life like that. This book that I put out, The Patient, the Doctor, and the Bill Collector, this is the first book I've ever written, and I've co-written it with a partner of mine. But along the way, I was always interested in communicating. So when Occupy Wall Street came along, I became a chronicler of that, and I started writing about Occupy Wall Street for the Huffington Post. And then I met a lot of other fellow journalists, because one of the reasons I started blogging about Occupy Wall Street is because everything I read in mainstream media did not relate to anything that I saw going on. And you know that yourself from your own experiences in New Zealand.
Oh, I know that feeling, sure, brother.
You know that feeling. That what is reported in the press has absolutely nothing to do with it, what is actually happening on the ground.
Which is so why I had to throw out my television, and conveniently my radio and my car broke, and I don't have the money to fix it. So I'm completely cut off from the bullshit media, and I've been surprisingly more well informed ever since.
Well, you're more well informed because of what we call alternate media. So in Zuccotti Park, I participated with people that were journalists, and a couple of years ago we were having an anniversary for September 17th. It's called S17 in our language up here, and got a bunch of journalists together in the park, and every one of us have devoted ourselves to getting out the truth as opposed to the propaganda that mainstream media puts out there. Do you have any mechanism like that in New Zealand or Australia?
What do you mean? Like just a general mainstream media, massive brush of scumbaggery?
No, anti-mainstream media, social media people that blog, people like you that get on the radio and operations like this.
In terms of, there's four types of media generally. There's the online blogging and article writing, and in which in New Zealand there's a lot of good writers. There is publications, there's Organic New Zealand and Uncensored Magazine and the New Zealand Journal of Natural Medicine. As far as I know, they're the only three publications that kind of like broadcast the truth, apart from, Investigate Magazine as well. So people have some options there in print. But in terms of radio, in terms of video, there's me, you know, doing it regularly.
Kind of lonely, isn't it?
Well, no, because I get all those bloggers and all the publishers and things like that on the radio, because they're busy doing their work, and frankly, it's so much easier to talk to people who work for a living in this industry, because they don't require a whole lot of prep in order to talk intensively about a particular subject matter, and they wind up delivering better news on radio than most professional talk radio douchebags like me.
Absolutely, yeah. I want you, that reminds me that I should invite you and your listeners to go onto LinkedIn. I have a group on LinkedIn called Occupy Everywhere. It's the longest running Occupy group on LinkedIn, and it's the largest. I think we have well over 2,500 people at least, who are all over the world, who come to LinkedIn into this thing called Occupy Everywhere to be able to post things and to communicate back and forth. You're invited to do that, and I invite all your listeners to do the same.
Well, hopefully that thing doesn't, dry up and shrivel away and just become the LinkedIn memorial.
Well, it's interesting about Occupy. A lot of people have wondered whatever happened to Occupy. And that is the that is the most unknowledgeable.
Can I interject for a second? Because, you know, people can't say, oh, whatever happened to Occupy. You never even knew that Occupy existed for, like, several months after the occupation had started, before mainstream media started even giving it any coverage. And then it was demonizing coverage. I mean...
Yes, it was.
But anyway, you were saying?
Well, it existed for a blink of an eye. And it was the most outrageous, wonderful, raucous event that ever happened. And, of course, keep in mind that Occupy itself was a reverberation of what was happening in Tahrir Square in Egypt, that was happening all over the world, in which people were saying, we're sick and tired of this shit. Occupy, because of New York City and its renown, and the fact that we were able to get away with things that other countries wouldn't allow for, we actually managed to live and thrive for 3 months, I think it was. And at that time, the police came in, closed down the park, and we scattered like leaves to the wind. But when we scattered with purpose. And there are a lot of people involved in Occupy at that time that are still out there, like me, in various ways, making a contribution to the betterment of society that wouldn't have happened if we hadn't had that experience. So I invite every one of your listeners, anytime there's a chance to get involved in a demonstration of a demand for civil rights and for correcting abuses, join that thing. Get an experience of standing jowl to jowl, shoulder to shoulder with other people that you don't know, but you have one thing in common, and that is you want to voice your disapproval of the status quo. So you, in your way, have done that, and you've gone to the radio to be able to do that. People do it sometimes with blogs. Some people do it fighting individual things, like, for example, climate. These idiots in America that don't believe in climate warming or global warming, there are a lot of people in Occupy who are busy working with organizations that are setting about to educate them and prove to them that this is the case. So it's all about education. It's about being willing to get out of the goddamn spectator stands and get down onto the field and play the game.
I was just thinking about this, like, Occupy 2, Ryan. Like, bring it back, but this time we've got to do it a little bit differently. There actually does have to be a very media-savvy approach to it. Like, not going so hard out anti the media scum. It's kind of ironic there. Try to court
the media. You and anybody else, I'm going to give you my email. You and anybody else involved in media and wanting to make a difference in alternative media, write me at JerryAshton1, that's a numeral one, JerryAshton1@gmail.com, and I'll begin to introduce you to many of the other online and offline Occupy-oriented people who are making a difference by getting out the truth. So I need to connect you with some of my folks, and certainly we need to connect ourselves with everybody else around the world.
Well, see, I'm always like a floater. Like, I haven't actually joined anything or gotten a job with anyone. I only just kind of like work in and out, and that way I can come in, do some work, be a bit of help, and then go back to doing my own thing, go and help somebody else.
That's nonsense. You need to join arms with other people. Your job is not to be a lone voice. Your job is to be able to be a voice. And the more you can work with other people to see that that voice gets out there, the better it's going to be.
Oh, yeah. That's what I mean. Yeah. That's why I work with a lot of different people and give them all a voice on the radio show, including yours.
Well, thank you. And I want to do the same for you. And I want to see that others here in America and Britain and around the world have that same opportunity. If it hadn't been for you and I connecting, 3 years ago, we wouldn't even be having this conversation. I guess. How did you learn about what I was doing?
Oh, I got a random email out of this morning, and I was just like, you know, a bit hungover because I had a long weekend. I had two friends' 40th birthdays, and I was like, oh, God, I got no guests today. All right, what have I got? I've got like a couple of hours until my show starts. Okay, let's have a look down my emails. There he is, Jerry Ashton. Okay, boom, send him an email. He's okay with it. Fantastic. Heart attack averted.
I love the idea of serendipity.
The word is synchronicity.
And that too. Synchronicity is where the universe really is working for us. We think it's working against us, but it's working for us. We need to synchronize. We need to understand that we're all connected.
Bro, I have to tell you the most amazing stuff. Like, over the weekend, right? Okay, two of my good friends who are listeners to the show, and one of which who does the designs for my website, were both having their 40th birthday parties on the same day, right? And they both live a fair distance.
Really?
Yeah, and they both live a fair distance away from me. So we go to the first party, and then I'm also there with my mate Mike, and we're performing and stuff like that. And then I meet my mate Russell, who 8 years ago was living on the same road as the other 40th birthday that I'm going to afterwards, right? And what also happened 8 years ago is the guy whose 40th birthday we're going to afterwards started his chili sauce company, right? And on our way there, I was thinking about my mate Brenton, who I spoke to and said that, bro, you should blow off your weekend of work. You should come with us. You should come and have a road trip. You should come and play some music, bro, and party with some great, you know, truthers and stuff like that. He's like, no, I'm going to do this. And I was like, so bad. And then we met one of his friends up there at the party, which was like 400 k's away. Right? And it was just like extraordinary. It was like boom, 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 right after the other one. And one of the girls that I met there, her mother was best friends with one of my really good activism friends, Penny Bright, right? Who's like one of the biggest activists in the country. And another girl who was there, she was actually friends with a lady named Karen, who I interviewed 2 years ago about this really massive pedophile ring that was being run in New Zealand by people who were like King's Cross recipients, you know, prestigious people. And she was one of her friends, and she's no longer with us anymore. So it was just like a shit ton of synchronicity just happening in one weekend, you know?
It makes you respect. It makes you respect the divine wisdom, doesn't it?
Exactly. And my mate Brenton should have fucking listened to my divine wisdom. He would have gotten real. He would have had some great time.
Well, there's some wisdom less divine than others.
Well, you don't get a second chance at a first impression.
In that case, we've blown it.
See, that's what happens when you value work over fun and friends. And it was like, I remember we were sitting around the table and we were all like really, really kind of just tired. You know, we've been partying for like 2 days straight and sat around. I cooked everybody a bit of bacon and eggs for breakfast. You know, people like leaning in the window, man, that smelled really good, Vinny. And I go, I know, you know. But we're having this conversation about what's valuable, you know. And
yeah. Okay.
I used to value money. I used to value titles. I used to value a whole lot of things, but then I realized that the only thing that actually has its own intrinsic value and the only thing that's really worth something when it comes down to it is other people.
Mm-hmm.
Nothing else actually really matters, you know?
Yeah. When you're sitting in the company of like-minded people and you know the rare moment where everyone is in enjoying themselves. They are in joy. The very fact that they're connecting as human beings and they have this totally unqualified appreciation for one another. That is an experience that you cannot buy with money. It does not come with a title. It comes with the amazing experience of a human dealing with another human in a fashion that says, I love you and I appreciate you and I really don't even have to understand you. So I tell you, I'd be on a plane right now to go to that party.
Oh, well, you know, you can't snag every opportunity that comes your way. It's just the unfortunate thing. What would have been really cool is to go to my brother's 40th birthday that I missed out on. He was with a whole bunch of his mates. I think maybe about 17 of his good mates they've been friends with for like decades, right? And they all hired a big, big boat for them and their families and everything. And they're just like cruising around Tahiti, going to islands and swimming and having like a huge amounts of like really nice food and drinks and stuff on board. Oh my God, that would have been bitching. And now here's another thing that I've noticed as well. A lot of people who get into serious topics, politics and things like that, they often stop socializing to a large degree. And they actually, I think they should do it a bit more, because sometimes when you're fighting for other people, but you don't hang out with them and you don't have fun with them, you're in danger of forgetting what you're fighting for and who you're fighting for.
I have another view on that, too. One of the big deals about Occupy Wall Street was that there was the 1% versus the 99%. That's a pretty clear distinction. The problem is, within the 99%, not everybody qualified to be the 99%. You were too this, you were too that, you weren't enough of this, you stepped up too much, it's nonsense. So what happens is that it's very, very important to reach out to people in the 99% who don't agree with you. Keep in mind, they're not part of the 1%. That doesn't mean they can't disagree with you. So it's being able to reach out to these people and to connect with these people and put aside the judgments and the politics and say, what can we do together? And that was proven to me most recently with a media group that's been promoting my book and RIP Medical Debt, and their name is Black and Blonde Media. Now, they happen to be a black fellow and his lovely white wife, and they are totally conservative. Not exactly the kind of people that I'd invite to a party at my place. And yet, we both appreciated each other's qualities so much, and they appreciated the need to get out the word about what we were promoting, which was the abolishment of medical debt, that we put aside these differences and said, let's work together. And I don't think I've enjoyed working with people for a long time as I have with these two. If you haven't had that experience, I think you ought to reach across the aisle and connect with the people that you think are not agreeing with you.
Oh, yeah. I mean, when I work with Suzanne Posel, she does OccupyCorporatism.com. She got like a million lists. She got like a million hits the day both of our, you know, like collective enemies got arrested. We were like, whoa, yeah. Oh, boy. I love that. And we were just sitting there about a week before that, just trying to nail this guy's coffin shut. And we were working for about maybe, I don't know, 3 days and four nights kind of intensively making a video. And man, we had a lot of fun, because sometimes you just have to sit back and you're like, man, we're exposing these people so badly right now that you know, it just kind of like hits you in the face, sort of thing, that you work together so well that you create something that neither of you could have come up with or executed on your own, even if you had 100 years.
Well, the universe is very wise in the way that it set us up. The universe says that you move forward. Excuse me. The universe says you move forward left foot, right foot, left foot, right foot. It doesn't say right foot, wrong foot, right foot, wrong foot. So the problem that we have as humans is that we actually believe that we can make one of our feet wrong and still move forward. It just doesn't happen that way.
Well, it's that kind of strength thing, right? If you've got confidence in yourself and kind of like faith that things will get through, surprisingly enough, not only do a lot less bad things happen to you, but a lot more interesting, cool, useful, and productive things happen to you that are almost outside your control. It's because you stopped thinking bad things and you started opening yourself up to the possibility of good things to happen. And sometimes learning that skill requires you to suffer somewhat. And in fact, I recommend it. You know, if you've ever been down on the down to your lowest and down to your last few bucks, and you're homeless, and your family hates you, and you're basically at your wit's end, and that kind of thing, if you've been there and come back, it's a very, very difficult person to destroy that.
Well, that's a fact. It gives certainly you and anybody else a perspective that they wouldn't have had if they hadn't bounced along the bottom a few times. You don't have to necessarily hit bottom in order to be able to get back to the top. Some people are more fortunate. They might understand. They might see the light prior to the time that they have to go through what the universe requires, which is a wake-up process. If you don't wake up, they're going to continue the lesson. First, the lesson begins with a tap on the shoulder. And if you ignore that lesson, then it begins with a couple of taps on the shoulder. And then it goes on to a whack on the side of the head. And until you finally get the message, you're going to continue to get the lesson. Now, what is the lesson? The lesson is all people are connected, that we need to work towards a common good where everybody wins. That's the message. So everybody else is conflicted and has a problem being right about their way of how everything should work. Need to forget that. Otherwise, they're going to be achieving the same pain. It's a cleansing process. You went through a cleansing process in order to get to where you are right now.
I would call it a dirtying up process, but yeah.
Well, whatever it is, you went through hell and back. Not everybody has to do that.
Well, here's the problem with it. And I talked to a couple of veterans who watched their friends die, best friend, you know, known from school, that kind of thing, joined the army together, died in his arms because the CO ordered not to return fire and, like, led them into an ambush, you know, peacekeepers.
Mm. Uh-huh.
And I asked him something, that you experienced this trauma. Did all of you come back? You know, all of you went away off to fight. Did every part of you come back? And he said, no. You lose part of yourself when you get that trauma, right? Now, I was wondering, is it actually trauma that's necessary? Does strength, does metal need to be tested in order for it to be strong? And is that test entirely up to you?
Well, that goes back to life being the grinding wheel. It really depends on the makeup of a person, how well they respond to the tremendous grace of nature of what happens in our society. How can so many black people, how can so many aboriginals come back from the pain of the grindstone that they're being put up against? So it's sometimes we're very, very lucky. Sometimes the grindstone just polishes us up and doesn't go any deeper. And others, it just wears them down no matter what they're made of. So I'm not to judge anybody else's experience in this world, nor are you. All I can do is appreciate that somebody else's reality is just as true for them as mine is for me. And I search for the common ground. What do we share in common? What is our common humanity? And what do we need to do about that to see that others share in a greater picture?
Of course, if you're having this conversation with somebody who's incredibly drunk, it might not go so well. There's just this kind of aggressive undertone that comes with it. But
look, Now, I happen to have family that would not understand a word that I just said.
Well, I got this saying, some people shouldn't drink, some people shouldn't smoke weed. But fortunately, I'm neither of those people.
And I think we should recruit more.
Yeah, I mean, in fact...
Speaking of that, in the U.S., they're finally getting legalized medical marijuana and a few other social... In Colorado, which is leading everybody, they're getting rid of the stigma of medical marijuana and marijuana in general. What's happening in New Zealand?
I just had a post on Facebook today about this particular... I guess we could call him an urchin, Mr. Peter Dunn, who's been. You're going to love this. I mean, and by love it, I mean really, really hate it. He's kind of been in Parliament for the last 10 years, and his condition for being in Parliament and lending his support to the other people is, you guessed it, cannabis. No legislative change whatsoever, right? And somebody posted a meme about him today. What does this clown know about health? Peter Dunn, the ass Osiet Health Minister of Health, right? He voted against smoke-free bars. He accepts donations for travel from tobacco companies. He voted against raising the age limit for alcohol. He has meetings with representatives from the alcohol industry. He voted against the alcohol reform bill. He voted against the casino control bill and continues to vote against medical cannabis. Now, I put it up with a post about how this guy is a murderer and torturer by proxy. The sheer amount of people that are currently suffering and have died in New Zealand that would have been helped by medical cannabis is this guy's fault, right? He should be facing life in prison instead of a lifetime in politics. But that's just my two cents on it. Jerry, are you still there? Or have we had a little malfunction again? I think we have. Quickly hang up and ring back, bro. It only took a couple of seconds to reset last time. She'll be right. I just listened to my rant from, I think it might have been last year, about Peter Dunn for over an hour. You know, it was a good rant, because let's face it, when you're angry with somebody who is absolutely reprehensible, whose position is completely indefensible, it's just great radio, you know. Because I think that hate, I really do believe that hating something... Oh, hey, Jerry. I was just saying that I really think that hating something can be good, just so long as you're hating something that's actually worthy of being hated, you know? People hate things like, I hate cannabis users. Really? The ones that have... why? All of them? Really?
You know, that's a really interesting question. In the U.S., we hate haters, and it's a pretty good idea that we hate them, because why would we allow them to exist? So, but here we are employing the same weapon that the haters do in order to annoy us with all the things that they hate. Now, we got lost somewhere when we were talking about medical marijuana, and I do believe that the NSA and the alcohol industry has intercepted our call.
If you say so. They do.
Absolutely.
Well, it happened last hour, I think, around about the same time. So often when you have tech difficulties, there's usually a set time limit on things like recorders and digital connections and so on and so forth. And yet, it doesn't normally happen on this show, like not like that. And it's happened twice, right?
Well, that shows you a lot about my popularity in the NSA and Yeah. And the people who like to do thought control.
It was so strange because it reminds me of an interview I did with Gordon Bowden. He's this dude who's like uncovered the, you know how everybody knows that there's bound to be like some massive fraud going on, like at a global scale by heaps of ruthless criminal bankers who have like fake shell companies and stuff like that. And they're just milking money and getting people to invest in things that don't exist and just taking it and saying, oh, it was a high risk investment.
He actually found all the documents, bro. He can actually, like, prove it in court. And I'm like, whoa, you know, talking to him. And the Skype wouldn't work.
And when I called him up on his landline in England, there was crackling so bad he could barely hear what I was saying. So I Skyped him back, and I could barely hear what he was saying. And so on and so forth. I think we had like disconnection and reconnections like maybe 6 times or something with all sorts of weird stuff that had never happened to either of us. Like he'd been using Skype and talking with it for years and years and years, and I'd do it for a living, and it had nothing like that had ever happened before. We were like, there's something going on here, bro.
Well, it's obvious I'm not as important as this fellow because I've only been interrupted a few times.
Well, once we got all the tech difficulties sorted, we went through a full hour of interview without interruption. And in fact, I still haven't even published that interview. It was pre-recorded. It's in the can for a later date, you know, just in case I need to take a day off or something like that. Like tomorrow, I really wanted to take a day off today. In fact, Jerry, but I couldn't. Felt obligated to do this show.
I'm glad you didn't, because it gives us a chance to talk. Any other questions you might have for me?
Well, have you ever heard of the film Repo Man or Repo the Genetic Opera?
Repo Man is a very famous film in which...
No, not Repo Man. Repo Men. There's a recent one with Forest Whitaker and Jude Law.
No, not at all. Tell me about that.
Right, well, both films are centered on the premise of that there's a future where most people are very, very sick, and a lot of people will loan money from medical industries to give them artificial organs. And because they don't have any money to pay back the debt on them, and because those artificial organs can be reused, they employ repo men who are now legally able, due to a new act in Congress, to go and recover their organs from people who don't pay their bills.
Yes, I am familiar with that film.
Okay. I was just wondering, in terms of like medical debt repayments, how much of a fantasy actually is that, or if this kind of terrible way that we're going around the repo debt system at the moment in regards to medical bills, how far off is that?
Well, that's the far end of fantasy. When you take a look at the fact that if I have a medical problem in America and I don't pay the bill, and it goes to the bill collectors, and it's sold to the debt buyers, that debt will be pursued for years. The only thing they can get out of me, hopefully, is money. In the future, the imagination in some films and some fantasies is that what they'll do is they'll repossess my gallbladder. So that's the worst of all worlds in the bill collection industry.
It's... Who knows? I was going to say it might even be more humane, but no. It's definitely not, because you're actually killing someone in order to get the debt back. The ideal is to get the money and then kill the person by stress so that they don't borrow off you again. But
right. These people will no longer qualify.
I'm sorry, you're disqualified from our evil, evil debt system. It's like, cheers, bro. You know what is.
Yeah, one of the things that we've been working on in RIT medical debt we came across is, in America, veterans have medical debt that's unpaid. Now, in America, we think that anybody that we send off to all these foreign places to do what they do And when they come back, we should be taking care of them, and they should have all their needs taken care of, certainly medical. That doesn't happen in America. Believe it or not, these American veterans can run up bills that they cannot pay because they have a hard time even getting jobs when they return. And they end up owing medical bills, and they get into the debt collection industry. RIP medical debt has located over $1 billion of unpaid military medical debt that we want to raise money for, we want to get donations for, in order to abolish. Now, before that sounds too impossible, I want you to understand how the debt industry works. They buy the debt from the hospitals for as little as a penny on the dollar. So they'll take for us to be able to go to that same industry and buy $1 billion worth of medical debt that's not paid, we only need $14.5 million. Now, that $14.5 million may sound like a lot, but it's nothing compared to the kind of money that goes out to charities today. They have something called the Wounded Warriors Program in America that brings in hundreds of millions of dollars a year. Where's that money really going? So we set up this foundation and we started to focus on American veterans to see that we can abolish their debt. So we're out there chasing down money. That's one of the reasons why I'm talking to you now, is to make sure that we get out the word that American veterans need to be able to have some relief as well.
Well, see, I've got a soft spot for veterans, particularly American veterans, because they're not actually cared for as well. However, just in general, this is the most horrible thing that you can ever do. You sign up and you sign your life on the dotted line, and you go off and you get injured and you come back and you've got a black mark on your name for absolutely no reason. You can't find work, just so that it's actually a hell of a lot more difficult to do something other than go back into the service and go overseas and get more traumatized and maybe even injured horrifically. And then when you come back, you're so frazzled that you can't even communicate with your friends and your family anymore, and you get really depressed about it. And then you go to the Veterans Administration and you take psychotropic drugs, which have one of the side effects of committing suicide, and then everybody blames you and says, oh, you're a crazy veteran when you die. You know? That kind of shit.
It's horrible. It's horrible. I don't remember the exact number, but there could be anywhere from 1 to 30 suicides a week. American veterans, post-traumatic stress syndrome, who just can't take it anymore. And by not taking it anymore, it's not only remembering what they went through, but the very fact that as part of that stress, they're being collected on by people, by bill collectors, for monies that they owe doctors because they can't even get into a VA hospital. So it's enough to boggle my mind. I don't even have my hands around it, my head around it. And I'm doing what I can as an individual and in partnership with others, reaching out to donors saying, this has got to stop. So I grant you that we're dealing with symptoms. We're not dealing with the disease. But if we don't help the people with the symptoms, we won't even have enough energy and time to be able to address the disease. We need to do both at the same time.
That's right. Jerry Ashton, ladies and gentlemen, nomoremedicaldebt.com. Go there, support him today. We'll see you again sometime.